Okay, so welcome everybody again. This is the Wednesday show on Achieve Radio. This should be Wednesday, July 16th, although who knows how many Wednesdays we'll end up traversing as Bob and I get into this presentation here this evening. So on the line with me, or on the radio with me this afternoon, is the one and only Bob Neverett, who I've invited here especially to talk about his Cold Fusion Now interview that he did with Ruby Carrot in December 16th of 2012. This was originally commented on by me on myRNADropsBlog.com. You can go to myRNADropsBlog.com and get the post that actually we're going to be talking about here, and follow along. So first of all, welcome, Bob. Hi, Bob.
Yes, it's great to be back at Wednesday show. Wednesday show, that's what it's called, right? Wednesday show?
It is the Wednesday show, the Wednesday show. Yep.
Yes, the Wednesday show. And this is a good topic. I'm interested in taking as long as we want on this.
Very good. Yes. Yeah. So I know this week we have 3 hours because Vincent J. Barra is on vacation. So we're going to take up the 3 hours talking about this. And this is going to be an excellent tutorial, I believe, Bob, on how to interpret properly the teaching that you laid out. So that just goes to show you how vast and comprehensive your thesis and your information is, that we have to have a tutorial to talk about your teaching, but we do. This is, if you go to myRNADropsBlog.com, you'll see across the top of the page that it says Imaginators, and if you click on that, you will see a post, Start Upgrading Your Imagination. And I posted this back in 2012, and this is an amazing, amazing presentation of information. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this, Bob, is I took the challenge that you laid out in the actual presentation that you did with Ruby. At the very end, you say you should listen to this once a week or once a month until you figure out what I'm saying. That's what you said.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I heard it in December of 2012, and at that time I decided I'm going to do that. I'm going to listen to this thing once a month until I can figure out what Bob's saying. And only recently have I really figured it out, and I, as a matter of fact, have listened to it 4 times in the last 3 weeks, and it's just such a great presentation of information that I said, I got to have Bob on, and I want to go through it line by line, and let's really hash this thing out.
So you didn't listen to it once a month, did you, over the last 2 years?
I don't think I did it for like the first 3 months. Then 2013 got crazy, so I didn't really do it much in 2013, but I picked it up again probably at the beginning of March, started listening to it again.
Right, good. Yeah, it's and you were very busy in 2012, 2013, creating all the websites, so you have a good alibi.
Yes, I was very employed in the Ionic world, yes. So I was busy doing my thing, but I didn't really take the time to. Well, and plus at that time, you had just been doing the Payday show, I think, on Thursday evenings. This was in 2012, when you had a very dialed-down version of Payday. And this is when Michael Brown was hanging out with you a lot. As a matter of fact, he wrote a blog that you can also see on my blog that fed off of your presentation of this information. And so this was the time that Michael was hanging out with you on Payday, and you guys were chatting up, but you were still only doing, you know, a couple hours a week, nothing, when you got into the vast presentation of information that you started to get into
on Saturday, when you did
the Bob Fest, yeah.
Oh, the Bob Fest, yes, that was a good leaping point, and then Bill gave us the huge Saturday, Sunday, as many hours as I wanted.
Right, so it was hard to do the two-hour Cold Fusion a month, everything, when you were laying out so much on Payday. So actually, this is turning into a nice little time, because I know according to this time of this recording of this show, that you're planning on taking a little bit of a hiatus from your show during the month, for the next couple of weeks. So this will give people a chance to really listen to this. This is good.
Yeah, it'll be we're going to miss we'll do one more show. What is it? The 19th. Do the 19th of July, and then there'll be five missing weeks. But Bill can, he'll probably rerun these paydays. But I think people can go on the chat line and talk. You know what I mean? I think the chat line is still active. And if they get together like they do on Saturday night, they can talk up a storm. And if anybody does, copy the data so I can read it later, you know, the chat
line. Good. I'm sure Wendy will
say this, Jeannie,
do that. Yes.
What did you just say? Was the last one?
I said, I'm sure Wendy or somebody will do that for you, Bob.
This show is being broadcast on the 16th. That's the anniversary of the atomic bomb being blown at, I think they called it Trinity, on July 16th, 1945, you know, a few weeks before Hiroshima. This is the anniversary. That's pretty well, what is that? That's 69 years. And 69 was a very important number in McLuhan land. So we can dig. He died, passed on at 69, too. He would always go to he got a new book, he would go look at page 69 first to sort of make a judgment about the book based on what he found on page 69. And then he did his first pre-understanding media project for the National Educational Broadcasters Association of the United States. He did a report for them, and the nickname for it was Project 69. And it became so controversial, it was discussed and argued about in Congress. That was in 1960. And then Understanding Media is a replay of that report with some updates since, say, 61, 62, 63. Anyway, 69, this is the 69th anniversary, isn't it? 1945, 70 will be next year.
Yeah.
So this is 69. So it's a good day because this is, what we're going to talk about is as dramatic as the atomic bomb.
Very good, very good. And to qualify this conversation as well, we're going to state that we will not be, because of confidentiality and security reasons and everything, we're not going to be talking about the quote-unquote cold fusion technology itself. That's not on the table. What's on the table
We call it Coldplay. We do not want to be connected to the cold fusion mean, even though we talk about cold fusion just to get people started because they heard about that. But it's Coldplay, and we're not going to talk about how you can make it at home or any of the details. Enough has been revealed, even put out too much, and you'll just have to wait till you get one, and then you can look at it. And you know what do tinkerers do? They take it apart, and they'll look at the thing and try to figure out what's going on. They'll look for the fingernail.
That's right. So we're not talking about Coldplay and people's fingernails. Well, you do mention that briefly in this, but we're going to be talking about the thing that you said, which I thought was so imperative, which was you're going to have to start to upgrade your imagination. And this is also very serendipitously dovetailed in with several events that have happened in my personal world lately, one of which is operating the support line for RNA Reset and getting absolutely profoundly absurd comments from seasoned INets that suggest to me that perhaps they haven't fully embraced the 30,000-foot view of what's going on in INDEM the way that I would say in coaching. You know, there's 30,000 feet, then 15, 10, 5, and then sea level. And so you would want to have a very large vision. And I think that's part of what...
Yeah, we may be at fault for that. We have been just pouring out information. We have not provided courses or reviews. We've just been trying to keep up with ION. So they have an excuse. We've never really done what you want to do or what you think is required. No, we've never given. We do it here and there, but not in a good, intensive way in one spot. The implications that I kind of predicted in my talkings and writings before ION showed up. And that's what Ginny is going to... you can get to that point, what I saw. You know what I mean? Even though I didn't know it would come in this form. But I did have an inkling of something different than what science was looking for.
Correct. So we've got that, which is in part, which is consolidated through this presentation that you make with Ruby. The second thing, so we can talk about that, which we're going to. But the second thing, Bob, I just want to...
I want to tell you something about Ruby, but go ahead. Finish your point. Yeah.
I want to just challenge what you said, that we've never really done this. Because, Bob, I will still point to McLuhan on Maui as one of the most comprehensive and best educations, not just on the five bodies, but on the chip body, ion's relationship to it, and again, having a much larger vision for iondom than just come in, get your drops, and get your, you know, American dream money scene straightened out. This is a huge, you know, and vast kind of architecture that we've stepped into. So, I think McLuhan on Maui was a very good seminar, Bob. I don't want to say we've never done it before.
That's a good point. We should emphasize that that was an early teaching, and I was there for much of it, especially in the later sessions, 33 sessions. So that's a good point. That's mandatory to listen to the McLuhan on Maui.
Yeah, you've got to get to McLuhan on Maui. So this is nice because we're setting up a little bit of homework for you, for people while you're on your break, and also just in general what they can benefit from. So Ruby, go ahead.
Yeah, this is cute. I met Ruby through Jerry Fialka at Fialka Funny Farm, middle 90s or something, or late 90s. And she was a person living in L.A., and she was a peak oil fanatic. And
now, what's peak oil?
Mike Rupert emphasized this, that we got a big crisis because we're running out of oil and everybody's going to be grabbing for whatever's left over and we didn't know what to do with ourselves. And he linked it to the cause of 9-1-1, that the Americans had to get over in Asia to get the oil over there and all that stuff. So this was the fear that we were running out of oil. And then we didn't have that, we had nothing. And then it's chaos and dark ages and all that stuff. Well, that's what Ruby was an expert on this theme of peak oil. So I was just casually saying, oh, that's not important. And I was talking about cold fusion and Pons and Fleischmann, and she thought I was a nut. And she already thought I was a bit of a nut because she didn't understand the McLuhan stuff either. So a few years later, something happened. She heard some information which blew her mind and thought, oh, maybe there's something to this cold fusion. So from that point on, 2005 or something, she would, whenever I was in L.A., I'd see her, and she would talk about how this cold fusion was right, and she was amazed that I had kind of was the leading edge on that. And she was beginning to read McLuhan and catching on that. And she ended up teaching up in Northern California, Eugene, Oregon, or Eureka area, up there somewheres, because she's college-level professor of math. And she wrote a book, and you'll hear it on one of the McLuhan, on the McLuhan of Maui. She calls in, and Ion addresses her McLuhan-esque history of math. If you remember that, she talked about...
Right.
Stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Robin Carter. That's Ruby. That's her real name, or her other name, Robin Carter. So she went from thinking I was a nut on McLuhan to teaching it at university whenever she could to the freshman levels. So she became an expert on McLuhan, and then she became James Martinez required, since he was starting, thanks to my interesting him in the cold fusion and getting more and more involved in his passing interest, he started interviewing scientists, so he needed a website to make these, to post these things, and he got Ruby volunteered to run the website. It's called coldfusionnow.org, I think. So she got very involved in the cold fusion teachers and inventors community and an expert, and met them all and deeply involved, and she burned herself out about a year or so ago, and doesn't do that so much anymore. But the thing is that she always remembered that her interest and her debate with me began with me. You know, her debate with Coldplay and about whether I was sane or not. And it turned out to be a great serendipity or synchronicity that I ended up giving this great interview to Ruby, who was my first, like, one of the first people I discussed it with 10 years before or something. You know what I mean? So it's very, very timely or appropriate that Ruby is the one that reviews all that she'd learned over those last few years doing the site and trying to fit it back into McLuhan and what Bob was saying. And so that's why she picked me for to do the interview for the Mayan calendar day, you know, December 21st, is it? Yeah, December 21st, 2012. That's what it was broadcast on.
Right, and I like, thank you for summarizing that about who Ruby is and what her background is, because
yeah.
She is clearly very articulate and familiar with your information, familiar with McLuhan. She is a student of it. She is definitely grasping or grappling with the information, and also the effects of the Android meme, which you talk about very eloquently in here. And this is why I'm also pleased. Like, for example, Ruby, I think there's some of the early people like a Ruby and Eben Ray are perfect examples of people who were very confused and challenged by your material, but they didn't write it off. And
right.
As Eben says, the most important thing you could do would be to become a student. Now, to me, I just want to use this as a segue to say, this is the difference between, say, those two and, say, a Randy Moggins, who had the ultimate opportunity and may end up in an Apostle Paulish kind of fashion, end up circling back around and becoming, you know, more involved and more engaged, because he's obviously on to something. He does have that kind of Apostle Paul approach where he's kicking against the thing that he's also circumspectly fascinated with,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But Randy is a perfect example of somebody who didn't become a student, they became a critic prematurely,
yeah. Yeah.
You know? And this is another thing that I wanted to do the show to say, let's take some time to dissect this information and see if there doesn't come out to be some very important information here that you can use and apply to, as you say, Bob, upgrade your imagination.
You're going to have to go back and look at the conceptual baggage as part of the social mortar, which is your imagination, your public imagination. That has to be updated, because your mind will fool you, and you don't know how good it is and what it knows and what it's pretending to make sure you don't know, and you exercise and find out and explore every thought that ever happened so that you aren't fooled by thinking anymore. So that's why you go into this stuff. That's why you have to do your homework, as well as enjoy and bask in the slack of Ion.
And this Ruby interview is just fantastic for getting you there. So without further ado, what we're going to be doing is we're going to go through the Cold Fusion Now interview Bob did in December of 2012. I've said it several times, but I'm going to say it one more time. MyRNADropsBlog.com, go to Imaginators, and then click on the thing that says Start Upgrading Your Imagination. And the gift of that, if you're with your computer, if you're not, you're listening to the archive, put the show on hold. Go get your computer, because I want you to be able to follow along, because this has been transcribed. There are a lot of quotes that Bob is going to say in this interview that are here, and we can look at some of the transcribed information as well, because it is complex, but it's easily understood, especially if you can engage the wordy words and also listen to what Bob's saying. So what Bob and I are going to do, we've not done this before, is we're going to start playing the interview. And when he or I have something that we want to say or something that I want him to add, I'm going to put it on hold and we're going to go into it further. So we strap in, get some pen and paper, or get a really good joint, whatever turns you on, and get ready for some great information that's going to be coming your way. So, Bob, you ready?
I'm ready. Thanks a lot for doing this, Ginny.
All right, here we go.
Hi, this is Ruby Carrot from Cold Fusion Now. Today is December 16th, 2012, and we're speaking with Bob Neverett, paramedia ecologist, and one of the people who has been intimately involved in accelerating cold fusion into our world today. Bob, are you with us?
Yes, hello, Ruby. Not only am I a paramedia ecologist, I'm a scientist now, since I've successfully made a cold fusion battery. And our battery is different because I assume everybody else is trying to get, or working with increased heat, maybe a little power, but First of all, we have, when we first developed this a couple of years ago, so much power is unleashed, we triggered a couple of earthquakes. Now, I'm not saying which earthquakes those were, but I just want to put it on record, that's what I do. That's what I'm involved with now. Now, we've learned to control the energy, the power, so that there's not earthquakes aren't triggered. But I want the listeners, if they'd only get 30 seconds to listen to this or a minute, I want them to know that that's how big of an operation our situation is, how powerful it is. So now you wanted to go into the history, I assume, of my interest in cold fusion.
Yes, I would like to definitely hear more about your cold fusion battery and how it's different. But, you know, you, Bob Neverett, are the one person who told me that cold fusion was indeed real back in 2004. Prior to that, in 1989, I was a physics student. And when we heard about the announcement of Drs. Martin Fleischman and Stanley Pons at our school, there was so much excitement. And quickly thereafter, everybody kind of became deflated. And we heard basically then that it was a mistake and that it wasn't really real. I'd like to get some background from you. When did you first hear about this, and when did you realize that there was indeed something to it?
I first heard about cold fusion and that term on March 24th, 1989. I heard the news item, and then a person I know named Michael Blake Reed was speaking in Toronto that night, 24th, 25th, to 26th, and he told me, according to his sources, that this was real. And this was going to be a phenomenal breakthrough, and Pons and Fleischman will be considered great scientists in history. So I immediately started looking for literature on it, or whatever I could, news, and pretty quickly the fiasco information happened. And then I found that the only person who was documenting the ongoing investigation was Eugene Maliv, who I became aware of and was in touch with. And then I noticed that the Executive Intelligence Review were monitoring the conferences. So for about a year, as news trickled out, I looked at it with the confidence that Michael Blake Reed had given me. And then when, by 91, when the first conference, I think, happened, and I think the Japanese guy caused a big sensation at that conference, plus Pons and Fleischman. I said, well, there is. The labs are starting to validate it. I think it was within 2 years there were about 600 labs that had validated it in different ways around the world. But certainly by then the world was not talking about it as if it was a big breakthrough. So the interesting thing is, since I was an expert on Marshall McLuhan's work and was an archivist, voluntary archivist for Marshall McLuhan, and I helped organize his archives after he passed on, I was aware that the information environment was not what people thought. I was aware that if you had a press conference and you sent out your information, there was probably not going to be the kind of reception you want because, first of all, the digital era was starting at that point, and there was so much information happening, information overload, that people were being very passive and just accepting what the mainstream news said just as a way of keeping a focus on reality of, okay, this is what the authorities say. There's all this other information I could look into on cable, but that's just for entertainment. I'm not going to take it seriously. Until the White House announces something's real, then that's what I got to wait for. Then I'm not going to take serious anything else. So the White House never announced cold fusion, and it came out that they had Fons and Fleischman had faxed their information here and there, and a lot of confusion. There seemed to be a naivety about making a press conference. Okay. So even though the White House wasn't going to announce it, or any respected authority aligned with the White House, I started thinking about how this meant what this meant in terms of media dynamics as McLuhan laid them out. Now, quickly, McLuhan said that every invention, every technology is an extension of one of our senses, either external senses or inner senses. And we knew that by the time of the satellite, that the satellite extended not our bodies, not our senses, but the whole planet. And thought about that, and I was thinking how Bucky Fuller said that the satellite or the rocket ship was the first time a human being could live inside an apparatus that simulated the Earth. You know, I had oxygen and necessities so that you could live in a little Earth while outside of the atmosphere of the of this planet. So I considered the satellite as an extension of Earth, of the Earth habitat, our habitat. So that was the final extension. So then I'm looking at, well, what happened next? Well, the digital media came in, and the digital media didn't extend our senses or the planet. It just extended the machines themselves, the analog electric machines or any digital machines that had been developed. So you had this extension of technology by itself with human beings sitting on the sidelines. That might have been partly the situation at the time Pons and Fleischmann had their press conference. They didn't know that the android meme is not interested in what human beings or what I call chemical bodies are saying about the media. The media is interacting for itself and feeding on itself. And so I developed this theory that the satellite was an extension of first and second nature, because you had the technical analog electrical media that went into making the satellite, but it was an extension of our physical habitat, what we would call first nature, as well as being technologically second nature. So I decided that the fusion that the satellite represented of first and second nature, and then when the digital technology took over, which I called the Android meme, where it was extending its parts, I decided this was fusion, cold fusion, in the sense of more energy goes out than goes in. That's how Pons and Fleischmann was talked about in the beginning. You violate the laws of entropy, and you have negentropy. So more energy is coming out than it's going in. So as the people went online in 95, 96, once HTTP protocols were out there and Netscape was available and everybody could get on pretty easily with their dial-up, I decided that the Android meme was trying to simulate the actual merger that cold fusion represented. Cold fusion was the merger of first and second nature with negentropic outcome, but analog media and the digital extension of that in the software world, the Microsoft, Apple world, that was communication taking on the characteristics of negentropy that cold fusion had, where you have information 24/7, and you can't stop it, and it's almost negentropy. It's still a world of friction, but people began to regard it as, well, this is an endless utopia of information. As a matter of fact, it's almost too much. So I decided to say that the Android meme, the second phase of technology extending itself, was miming in software terms what could only be done in hardware terms. And hardware terms is what Pons and Fleischmann did. They took a battery, or they developed this battery, and the idea was that it would give people energy so that their physical chemical bodies would have endless support for a physical shelter, which had never happened before. We never had a situation where we had endless energy keeping the fire going, the electrical requirements in our habitat continuously happening without any more input, never ran out of energy. That situation was what was anticipated by the implications of Pons and Fleischmann's breakthrough, but it was surrounded by the Android meme, which was giving us information software, information beliefs, information, perpetually, 24/7, as if it was negentropy and didn't die. So as I watched the Android meme take over people's interest and fascination, and people got very involved in extending their bodies and their beings through the Android meme that they the hardware issues of cold fusion and actual physical shelter seemed to be sidelined. And it wasn't until the Android meme collapsed in 2008, that's what we call the collapse of Wall Street, and even though technology kept being produced and refined in Web 2.0 towards Web 3.0, people realized that something had broken and the sociological trust factor in the information environment collapsed, so that banks couldn't trust each other in disseminating their funds and transfers and that. So a serious breach in the software hypnosis, the Android meme hypnosis, happened in a few years ago. This left the world ripe for a new kind of physical attention to our physical bodies and whatever else we could find out about our physical bodies. And I say that's what I was part of since 2009, is finding a new energy that supersedes the Android meme's software mimicry of Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion and actually provides something incredible for the physical body. So that's the, in brief, the sequence. Now, in 95, I wrote an essay, Up the Orphan Ante, where I spelled out how the fusion of first and second nature was implied by the Android meme, but in physical fact, hardware terms, Pons and Fleischmann seemed to be pointing to that. And since Pons and Fleischmann, if you start reading Infinite Energy magazine, which I did, there was all kinds of technologies offered or suggested, different avenues, different routes, different notions of alchemy, all kinds of things were floated, but nothing stuck, nothing held. So also we're fully aware that the Pons and Fleischmann in November 98, they were interviewed in Wired magazine. Wired magazine belatedly did a catch-up on the whole cold fusion world. And Pons and Fleischmann said he could understand why his breakthrough, him and Pons, I think it was Fleischmann who spoke, might have been Pons, said that he could understand... He could understand why there was not much encouragement for their invention by military people, the Pentagon and that. And he said basically they would be worried that this battery would get out and some kids or somebody would start playing with it and make some bombs around it. And so he sort of resignedly said, yes, that's the problem. If you announce a new energy that has a new power source that has this kind of consequence, you can expect the Pentagon to take it from you, do something in the name of national security. So in light of what my and my colleagues have developed, we're fully aware of that situation, so we are being very cagey and interesting how we are bringing it forth, this very powerful thing. So basically my stuff that I helped invent is not enhancing energy or heat. It is actually making it possible so that you have endless electricity. So we're calling that an extension of power to unlimited environmental access.
Okay. That is just a incredible, crazy amount of information, Bob, right there.
But to me, Ginny, but to me, as I listen to it, of course, I know it inside out. It is straightforward, simple, not too much jargon. You may have to sit and figure out what is software, if you haven't thought about it, what is hardware, and what is negentropy. Look up a few words and then realize that I'm laying it out pretty simple.
And, yes, I agree 100%. I want to go back through. I wanted to get that big whack of information out first. I wanted to go back through and pick up on a couple things. One thing that I thought was interesting was that you said that you got your confidence from Michael Blake Reed, who we know was involved and channeled the Evergreens. And then you went on to say that the White House never came out for cold fusion. So there was this other issue of, since, you know, people can't grasp it, if the White House doesn't say it's real, it's just not real, because that's how we're geared up on a civic level, on a political level in the United States specifically, although we will have people from outside the United States who will be listening to this show. And I think it's interesting that you're talking about somehow you've got to get a foothold of confidence in on just even contemplating the reality of what Coldplay could be. It's interesting to me that ION comes in and establishes such a high level of confidence and credibility with a lot of people around a whole lot of things, but yet somehow this leap into the whole world of Coldplay, people are still teetering on the edge. They don't have that bolster of confidence. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Now, note that I did not say what Michael Blake Reed did. I said his sources told him this was real. And his sources were the Evergreens. And this was March 23rd, March 24th, 5th, that week when it was announced. Michael occasionally would come to Toronto from the Vancouver area and offer public sessions with the Evergreens. People pay a few bucks, come in, and they get to talk to the Evergreens. The Evergreens were 6,500 to 7,000 entities that came through, channeled by Michael Blake Reed, I guess you'd say, from 1974 till 2004, 30 years. It became a very successful operation. Governments used them all over the world because the Evergreens, and I'd done many mediums due to my background through the decades, nothing was like the Evergreens. They were so good on all kinds. They were like ION. They could talk science and technology, and this, rather than just talk divine platitudes that you get in the Sedona magazines and the channeling magazines. This, any kind of knowledge system, like we know ION can do. So I'd done many sessions by 1989 with the Evergreens, starting in 1980. So here it is in March 23rd, 89. I don't even know that Michael's aware of the cold fusion situation. It just had happened a few days before, and I'm sitting in the audience, and he's doing an introduction. He liked these seminars because he got to talk. Most people would just talk to the Evergreens, and he never got to express himself. So he would introduce his life with the Evergreens and talk for half an hour and that. So right out of the blue, in there somewhere, he says, and this recent announcement about cold fusion, the Evergreens say, this is it. This is the breakthrough. We now, for the first time, will be called modern. History will look back at this period and say, yes, some people thought modernism started with the Renaissance, or modern reality started with the steam engine or something. No, because of what's going to come after cold fusion, it will be the big marker from the long view that when humans got the cold fusion, in the 90s, that was the thing that made us fully, really modern, the way people fantasize in science fiction modern was. So he really stressed the importance of this. And of course, the magic of it was he was saying this without my prompting or anything.
Mm.
I was just an anonymous person in the big crowd. And he was tuned in to what was interesting that week. And Michael always was that, very smart person. And, of course, he learned a lot from, because during the sessions when he'd go unconscious, he could see what the Evergreens were answering the client's questions about. So he learned an incredible amount of stuff while in this weird dream state. And so he always was up to date. And usually there was a magazine, a New Age magazine in Toronto called New Dimensions, and the guy who ran it, they dismissed the Evergreens. They said, well, Michael Blake Reed is obviously the guy. He reads a million books a day, and if you read that many books, you'll know a lot of stuff and sound like the Evergreens. He didn't know that Michael didn't read that many books, and he just knew Michael was intelligent, but they assumed that Michael could do the Evergreens. No, the Evergreens talked about stuff that Michael wouldn't look into. As a matter of fact, when I... In September 88, I think the date was September 13th, 88, I had a private session with the Evergreens, and I asked about what caused AIDS. Well, actually, no. We had a Mysteries of History session in Toronto, one of these public things with the Evergreens, and Dave Neufeld, at the end, asked about AIDS. Where did AIDS come from? What is it? And the Evergreens started to talk about what they called the viral debilitant and laid out the beginnings of a conspiracy. So after the session, Michael quickly walked out, and that was a Sunday night. I then had a private session on Tuesday. So I get there, and I'm asking his wife, Ellie, and Michael, why did you leave so quickly? And Ellie spoke. Mike wouldn't speak. Ellie said, this kind of conspiracy stuff really upsets Michael. He doesn't like it. Mm. He doesn't like it when the Evereens do it. And nobody really asked those kind of questions except for me. And I used to do the Kennedy assassination and all kinds of things with the Evereens to get their take on it. But the that was true, that Michael was disturbed by that kind of stuff, but he was really disturbed by what he saw or thought he saw in the scenario of who created the viral debilitant. And now, why am I saying this? So that happened in September 88, and then I was able that day, so that was Sunday night when Michael was upset. By Tuesday, he's a little more relaxed about it, and he's going to allow me to explore it. So I do an in-depth session on AIDS and find out incredible stuff, and later did a press conference on it, and it's now borne out. Well, basically, based on what Evereen said, they said it would last 29 years, starting in the year 1980. That's when it got activated, by scientists. 1980. 29 years, it would, by at the end of, since it was a program to become benign within 3 weeks, but it didn't work, so it took 29 years for it to become benign. The Evereens told me back then that it would be considered around 2009 like a head cold, 24-hour flu. That's how weak the virus would be. Now, I was asking Carolyn about a year ago, does anybody talk about AIDS anymore? Is anything happening? What is it? Are kids taught to worry about all this? Now, she says, no, it's not talked about. But we're not in touch with schools. We don't know what's being said out there. But it doesn't seem to be much on the AIDS. And so definitely it's been like that, a vacuum of concern over many years, and definitely by 2009, which is 29 years after the beginning in 1980. So I'm citing the kind of great stuff that Michael Blake Reed gave me through the Evereens, or through Michael, the Evereens gave me, and tremendous stuff. So when they told me about confusion, that's what I mean. I got a bit confident about this. They've been right so much already that, okay, I started from the premise that, oh, so it's really important. It's really going to happen. Let's find out more about it. And then I proceed in the interview to explain to Ruby the deflection, the slowdown, the nothing. You know what I mean? But I kept through the 90s talking to the Evereens about it. I've got all kinds of interesting recordings about Coldplay, about Cold Fusion. Through the 90s, the Evereens were always telling me what was going on with certain labs. They would predict what would happen to Pons and Fleischmann, where they'd end up working. They predicted the Japanese would take an interest, and they did, and this and that. So I kept up on the story on a level that nobody knew. So that led by 95 for me to have the confidence to start, okay, we've got to, our mind's got to find out the reason for this. How does this fit into the history of technological and poetry and science and art and media and the metaphoric way we think or the way we operate our minds? So isn't that, I guess that's what you're asking me. How did I get confident that's how it happened?
Okay, very good. And what, so I like the summary that you said, which was our minds have got to understand or get to the reason of what is precipitating the demand for Cold Fusion, Coldplay. And then in 1995, you write the Up the Orphic Anti-Thesis, which was basically your explanation of why Coldplay would actually come into the public.
Yeah. How it would follow, according to the beautiful vision that McLuhan had. Remember, you look at its history of media and technologies, you extend the ear, the voice, and then the eye, and then the muscles, and then the central nervous system or your tactile system. And then you extend the planet. It's a chronologically perfect, symmetrical, left hemisphere, linear process of the unfolding of our technologies, right? It went from the beginning of speech and ESP to gesture, and then through tribal spoken word dominated societies, then writing, then the printing, and then the industrial kinetic technologies, and then the electric technologies, which extend our tactile central nervous system. And then you have the extension of the planet itself, which is the satellite or the spaceship. So it's also poetic. So what comes after that? And so I remember I used to, in the 90s, I lived in New York City, and I would go up and stay at Nelson Tal's home, and he had been a very keen student of Marsh McLuhan, technically a student, took classes from him in the 70s, and we worked with Mary McLuhan and her center. She got an email from Mary today about what we're doing, but this is back in the 80s, And so we were always trying to understand Marshall, but by 94, 95, Nelson's begin to think there's something to this cold fusion based on what I was telling them. So one night, I laid out what you heard. I explained how the merger of first nature, which is the trees and snakes and rivers and that nature that we assume we did not make, right? Evolution says that evolution created it, survival of the fittest or whatever. But this layout of landscape, you call it the Garden of Eden, is now being interrupted with by humans' version of nature, and that's all our technologies, which we call second nature. Well, I had this vision, it was an epiphany, that first nature, which we were extending through second nature, were merging. And it began with the satellite, because it simulated the nature world we lived in and made a little room that you could sit in and fly out into space. So that was the beginning of a man-made environment imitating first nature, a beginning of the coming together of first and second nature. So I said, I had this idea, and I was telling Nelson that merger leads to negentropy, endless energy. And I remember Nelson, it was late at night in his bathrobe, we're up in his office in his home in Forest Hills, Toronto. You know, he was wealthy and he had a nice big house, and he's going, holy shit, because he kind of gets it, what I'm saying. He said, how did Marshall miss that? How did Marshall miss that? And he's trudging around in his room, his office, like shocked, because he thought Marshall figured everything out. And he realized I'd come up something past Marshall. And so his trauma was, how did Marshall miss that? We can't have Bob come up with something Marshall didn't think. So I, you have to see the humor around this. When I presented it to the human beings, what they said. So then I wrote the article, and then Nelson understand, and he was one of the first people to accept the fact that Marshall didn't figure it out to that level. So
right.
I was put on the pedestal by Nelson for having gone to a new level. And there's probably not too many other people who understood it like Nelson did. But Nelson had done his homework. He was well-versed on McLuhan stuff. We did radio shows on McLuhan, and, you know, he got reignited after many years of not knowing what to do when Marshall had passed on, and he didn't think he understood. But when he met me, I was able to explain to him in 83, 84, the Marshall stuff that he didn't get. So he became a real burning fanatic of McLuhan because he got the true vision from what I translated. But then, so that's 1983, 84, so we're talking 10 years later, I come up with this new scenario. And that was really good, and I was very proud of it. And I don't write papers, but I wrote a paper called The Optogorf Anti, you know, incompetently trying to explain huge ideas that even when I explain them now, we've got to go into it and explain them again and double track over it. They're impossible to understand. And I thought it was quite clear in my paper what I was saying. But it is an act of imagination you got to make, an act of perception, McLuhan would say. You have to change your perception. So you've got to work your way through the concepts and perceptions that led up to make you, if you're a baby boomer or Generation X, and then realize the limitations of that angle, that bias, and then you're going to have to adopt this new perception, which is like taking a drug, you know, a psychedelic. And you're going to have a new view that you never thought was there. So am I answering something there?
Yes,
so
no,
the
that's good.
Yeah.
Nope, you wrote the paper. And this idea about
and you know where it got published, Ginny? Around 98, these ravers and punkers and street people, because they were making zines, one of them made something called Flipside, which was a radical punk magazine with post-littered, non-literate, whacked-out psychotic people known as cyberpunks or punks writing and reading it. One of their more intelligent editors called me up on January 22nd, 1998, you can see it in my diaries, and asked me, he had heard some of my stuff in radio interviews, and asked me to write a column. So I called it Android Memes and Anarchy. So this most amazing information, most amazing essay ever produced over the last 30 years was put in a fucking punk magazine.
Ah, very cool.
So that's always the irony of how things start. They always start where you at least expect it.
Very good. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it says, I would have never expected all this coming out of just listening to Dolores Cannon talk about her hallucinations.
Yes.
Okay, so let me All right, so I want to ask.
So is it clear how what first nature is? The natural landscape that man is polluting, right? And he's polluting it with his inventions, which are second nature. So the vision you got to, the perception you got to figure out is how does first nature merge with second nature? And cold fusion, it's actually our cold play, is that fusion. So because the first nature never dies. It goes through changes, but its nature's always going on, never stops. You could say the universe burns up, but there's always another universe. So basically what we see stays. Okay, so that eternity factor in first nature, we're aspiring to get with a perpetual motion machine or something that's been a fantasy for a couple hundred years to make a technology that has infinite energy and doesn't suffer friction. Well, cold fusion is the way to do that. As envisioned by Pons and Fleischmann. But then you look around at the internet, which comes a few years after 89, and people by 2000 are trying to adapt, change their imaginations to live with a world that poured infinite energy, information on you 24/7. Now that is software negentropy, software cold fusion. It's software fusion. And then following McLuhan's tetrad principle, where you have a technology and goes along and completes itself, and it flips into something with its opposite characteristics, we would flip the information environment, its negentropy, endless abundance, into a hardware battery or box that would give you energy that you could house your outer bones and skeleton and skin in and not have to pay much rent for it, right? Because it was eternal. It was endless. That's what we're flipping into. That was the vision in the paper. We're flipping into a merger of first and second nature with the hardware part, the figure, the dominant. With the Android, with the internet and the Android meme, that was the merger of first and second nature with the software part dominant. You can't be warmed by the internet unless you're a mystic or something. You know what I mean? You can't. It doesn't pay your bills. It doesn't keep you warm in the winter. But a cold fusion battery will.
Okay.
Well, I call that hardware because it relates more to the hard chemical physical bodies we have.
Right, which would be in keeping in with what you said, and this is the point that I wanted to make. Well, there's many, but one of them is that what you said was since 2009, what you've been principally involved with is bringing forward the new energy that supersedes the Android's mimicry of Coldplay, which is the new energy, which turns out to be electricity, not necessarily like what they've been poking around with heat and all the rest of these things.
Yeah.
And this is where it flips into this idea or this hardware application, which is not just the battery, but then also our first nature, our physical bodies become hardware. And this is, I think, an important distinction for INETs because this explains why all of the sudden, like this, you want to talk about a shift in reversal or a dramatic reversal in perception, to be living in this very airy-fairy new age or esoteric world or a spiritual world or a heaven and hell kind of a world where you're relying on dying in order to live.
Yeah.
I mean, you rely on dying. This is where most people, the Ark of the Covenant, the cardboard box where we shoved all our power, is in the idea of death. Because it's just it's such an easy out on so many levels. Well, now Ion says, oh, yeah, about dying, yeah, that's not going to be happening anymore. Living, you'll be living now, and we're doing lots of living, eternal living, and it flips into this. Not only will you have a hardware, a drop, you know, a living water, a cold fusion battery, but your body becomes hardware, and you'll have to live. You'll have to figure out a way to get happy.
Okay, your body becomes hardware, software, and something extra. So now I don't know if I go into phase three in the interview with Ruby. I probably don't. I probably wasn't supposed to talk about ION in that interview, so I just talked about the first two phases. You know, the first phase that McLuhan cracked the code to with the help of James Joyce and Wyndham Lewis, that we are extending ourselves, and those environments take over, and we're actually end up being robots in the 60s of this amazing extension of early computer, satellite, radio, and TV, and all that. That's phase one. The digital phase, the Android meme phase, is no longer is technology an extension of our bodies, inner and outer faculties. The technology starts extending itself. This is the science fiction scenario, the Terminator, or any of the Philip K. Dick scenes, or any science fiction stuff where the technology takes on a life of its own. Artificial intelligence, HAL in the movie, the computer in 2001, 1968, Kubrick movie. This thing, which is quite, well, this imaging was shocking maybe in the 60s, 70s, 80s, but everybody knows it. It's in your normal TV science fiction fare now that technologies come alive and they take over humans or they do something weird to them. That's phase two. Phase three is not the extension of machines extending themselves or the extension of our faculties in the first phase. Phase three is the extension of what is called the non-physical. Because the first phase is physical, the second phase is physical, because the machines are physical and they're extending themselves, but this nebulous or something called non-physical completes what cold fusion was attempting to get to, what phase one was trying to get to, and what phase two is doing. Ion has declared that they run the cloud now. Because ion's the third phase, it can subsume the second phase and the first phase. It can control it. It's outside of it. So the big news is 2009 is that phase three, working with the extension of non-physical, we can do anything with our physical bodies and with our machines. And anybody who's been in Iondom knows that ion does incredible stuff to the point we have products that do what nothing else has done for thousands of years. That's the RNA drops and this other stuff that Carolyn worked on and invented, Remag, Relight. And just today, now this is significant, Ginny, we announced that we are showing for the first time a picture of the non-physical, the eye cell. Mm. That's what we announced on Carolyn's show today, July 14, 2014, that later this week, Chad will have up on our site, rnareset.com, the imagery of these eye cells. And I'm really interested in what people think about it, because I'm sure people say, oh, that looks like my grandmother's rug or something, or this and that. But others will somehow say, wow, that's awesome, never seen anything like that. So, well, we know what it is, we know what it does, we're not really interested in people's interpretations, but it'll be humanly curious, the reaction to this presentation, because Ion said that over the last few years, people with the death of the Android meme and receiving information or even having Web 2.0 and able to dominate and create your own space, your MySpace, the other space, and have a pretty good godlike control of your digital body, your chip body, with Web 2.0. What was I going to say about that? So people are bored. They don't try to keep up with information anymore. The Android meme, they kind of intuit. The Android meme is doing a life of its own and hasn't got much to say to the human body, the chemical body. So this has been this apathy, but puzzlement. Is there a possible new statement, reason, why things have gotten to this point where I'm kind of not sure what the point of being a human being is? And so this questioning is all over the world in humans' consciousness as the later stages of Web 2.0 and the Android meme, and especially after the collapse of it. You can see that in the Obama image. People were looking for a big image of hope. The thing came, it presented itself, and failed, right? That's a shocker for a lot of people, you know, that are trying to have a reason to put up with their tedious workaday lives. You know what I mean? So, So Ion said that people have been looking for whatever, looking for a reason. The mind wants a reason. Ion thinks that eventually ascended person doesn't require reasons, but little people have minds, and the mind dominates and needs to have its self-explanations. So Ion said that back in 2009-2010 that Ion would become more known and would present people good reasons, new reasons, and that's what we did on Cash Flow and on our radio shows today, is that we're presenting this talking maniac that comes up with new things, and people tell me, I listen to everything Ion says. I've listened to it for 3 years. I've heard all the archives. I cannot find anything that is erroneous or incorrect. His logic's impeccable. He makes total sense for our times. So people find that Ion gives the reason their minds are looking for. Well, so Ion told us last Friday, me and Carolyn in a private session, that we don't need to concentrate on advertising. We don't need to promote the drops. They're going to spread at the control pace so our factories can keep up with the expansion of it. But people still want to know, what is this stuff? They need a reason. And Ion says, when we put these pictures out, it will begin to satisfy the human's curiosity about what the mind is. They can see it, right? Seeing is believing. We're going to show them a strange image and say, that's what's causing this. And so that's what's important about presenting these images. Ion says it's going to do more for spreading the word on RNA drops and other things we make because they can see something. So,
very good. Okay, I get that. I can see the point in being able to see something because regardless of whatever kind of, and especially from working on the customer service line, regardless of whatever explanation you try to give people, they're still words and they can't physically grasp in with their eyesight what it is other than when they get the bottle and then they rely on, you know, their taste and things, but they're still not certain. So I think that's
because
fantastic.
We're a visually biased civilization in the long run. We're still visually
totally.
Biased. Seeing is believing is a big factor in the social mortar of your mind. That's why you need to understand where visual space came from, where this seeing is believing meme. That's what Randy Moggins is asking for. I want to see the JW. I want to see these things. I want to find out if it's really real. Show me something. You know?
Right, and what's funny is on the flip side, that this is what the Randy Moggins and the Matthew Judas Hurtados do, is they post all the links to all of the seeing is believing. Oh, there's a FBI site, or there's a federal this, or there's a thing here, or there's this, look at this important legal document, please do, Tactical Rabbit. And it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, it's so
there's
funny
the screaming.
That.
The screaming of a visual biased mind.
That's
and,
right.
Okay,
I saw it. I saw it with my own eyes. So now I know, but wait a minute. Because now I'm in conflict with my ear because I hear Ion live on the radio, but wait a minute. Now I'm in conflict again because I'm being told, well, that's not even, Ion's not even using JW's voice anymore. And it just presents this ongoing, you know, litany of confusion until, unless you can get up to the 30,000 feet, which is, you know,
the bird's
what
eye
if,
view.
Yeah, the bird's eye view. What's happening with what you said, phase three, the extensions of non-physical and Ion.
Non-visible. Ion comes out and says, what is visual is not real. What is invisible is real. And that is so true because part of phase two where the Android memes is extending itself, nobody really knows whether the information that's being presented to them has been faked or not. So there's not been a possibility of visual validation for 25 years because the Internet is a multiple sensory thing and the visual is very limited and anybody knows anything being photoshopped and faked. So we can't use our eyes anymore. And Ion is so perfect. If you think of Ion as a new wisdom source, Ion is the most up-to-date because he's taking what McLuhan and Finnegan Wake and Wyndham Lewis said and saying, that's the beginning. Do not go by your eyes. That's practical advice that should be taught to grade five-year-olds, to 10-year-olds.
Okay, now let's just play with this for a minute because, okay, I get what you just said. Now, we just turned around and said 30 seconds ago that there are going to be pictures of this non-physical substance in the eye, whatever, these eye cells. How do we deal with that dichotomy? Let's just talk about that. What you see isn't real, so does that mean what? The eye cells aren't real, or are they real? And if I'm seeing them, what and why would we post them if we don't, you know, that whole thing? You know what I mean?
Yes. Everybody can say, that's what I was saying, the reactions are going to be weird. People are going to say, this is a fake, this is or that. But Ion knew that we're so visually biased that there will be many people that will be impressed with the image. I could say they shouldn't be, but they will be. And it will satisfy their visually biased yearning for seeing something, and they will send me money. They will want to buy the drops because now there's something they can see. It's a bias, but it's I understand the cultural dynamic of Westerners, and that might even include Easterners and Asians and people, because everybody's going visual just because it's the last gasp in the tactile world. You go back and try to retrieve whatever you can do. That's why science takes over as an archetypal activity, research and development, so we can see something, you know, find it. R. Crumb had a great cartoon about this back in the Head Comics, 1967, where, you know, Flaky Flint or something, he finally is going through all these scientific experiments, and he finally looks through his microphone, and he can see it. He sees they have a little weird drawing, haven't looked at it in many years, but some little thing in his microscope. I mean, that's it. He sees in the microscope, he says, that's it, that's the key to everything, that's the source of life. And he's screaming and telling everybody, and the next and last panel of the cartoon, he's being marched off to the nut house by men in white coats. Right? Because he thought he discovered something visually. Anyways, it's a great cartoon, you know, 50 years ago. But we know, Ion's saying, we do all kinds of things, testimonials, acoustic testimonials that influence people, and then people's own experiences. They know the drops are unique, but some parts of our being wants the visual, and this nonsense, this fake picture that I painted, you know, 2 weekends ago, made it look really nice, that will convince people. So, yes, right. We acknowledge the visual bias. You shouldn't require that, but it will help our promotion or spread the word on the drops because of this visual bias.
Right, which is interesting because the funny part is that going back to what you said, well, you know, we're just doing this for you, JW and Carolyn, whatever. The flip on that is that, well, we don't need drops. We wouldn't promote them. We don't require any sales. You know, so it's interesting to see Ion accommodate all the different angles, degrees, and ratios because here's something that's not required, that's being offered, and it seems like Ion's working, quote unquote, like you say, with all the visual biases of the culture to present the information, present the opportunity, but in a totally detached way where they don't care, wouldn't have an agenda, and they're not concerned, nor does anybody else. So it's such a multi-tiered, interesting dynamic to be a part of.
And it's always making sure you don't get trapped in the environment that you think you are in. You know, its main slogan is don't stop. People stop. They say, okay, I am here in Maui. It's paradise. And now I have arrived. I can stop. I don't have to worry about anything. You know what I mean? And that's not the way to ascend. You never stop. You're eternal, and your curiosity and your questioning is part of your situation, and that's what you can enjoy. The more you understand, you can feel the accuracy of that knowing. You can enjoy all the questions that pop up. You can be quite flippant about it. That I'm a big example of that, of being flippant about this amazing work. I said to Randy Moggins, "This operation, IONDOM, is not a joke. This is the most serious thing that's come down the pike in many thousands of years." Now, I know that, but why would anybody else know that? But, you know, I've been watching this for 7,000 hours of conversation and other stuff with Ion. I mean, just, Ginny, you're the co-host with Carolyn of Carolyn's show. Every show, we have testimonials that any doctor would die for if you get one every 5 years like that. Carolyn gets them every week and says them on the show, right? If these miracles happen.
Well, doctors don't even know what a testimony are. They mostly just know, can I have another prescription, you know, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
I mean, you don't expect to walk in and do a, you know, hallelujah, amen, Jesus. Let me tell you, you know, I once was lost and now I'm found at the doctor's office.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's...
That's good.
In and of itself, it's just hilarious what happens. You're right.
Yeah, every week
absolutely.
On Carolyn's show. I mean, right now there's more success emails flowing in. I see it every day, and she just, you know, gathers them together, and we'll tell Ginny next Monday all this stuff. And you just can't have so much good news and dismiss it. So just on that, I don't care what Ian says about there are 12 JWs or there are five kingdoms or this and that, and Queen Elizabeth did that, and blah, blah, blah. The drops speak. That communicates. It's practical.
Yes, it is very practical, and that was the thing about flipping from the software into the hardware.
Yeah.
And then going back to this whole thing, phase one, phase two, and phase three, being in the phase three extension of non-physical, I remember when ION came out in the summer of 2011 and emphasized that money was gone, but the new currency were the RNA drops. This was the new way that people were going to be able to navigate through this new environment. And one thing that I've noticed, Bob, for the most part, is that the conversation, the money conversation in the core, you know, this core of INET is gone. People don't really ask Ian about money checks anymore.
No.
People usually come in, they get their drops, they get into the money starts flowing freely and easily to me. Things loosen up, and next thing you know, they're paying bills and moving around the cabin, you know, enjoying their cocktail and not being strapped into their seat. So I do
And a good example of that, Janine, is Deborah West, who called in today and had her latest epiphany.
Yes. Yeah. Deborah's a great example of that on many levels. Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
absolutely.
She sells cars, all antique cars, and every now and then it looks like nobody's going to buy one. It's over. And then she gets even more offers. And she's been going in this, you know, roller coaster ride for about 4 years now. And she's now come out of it so many times, she's pretty slack, relaxed about it all. She knows that she's always going to be functioning healthily, warmly with her economy.
That's exactly right, and that's a perfect way to say it, is with her economy, with her extensions of non-physical, with the drops or whatever, living water, cold fusion, a cold play, however that occurs. But the main thing, again, is not to get wrapped up in the content. It's the context, and this statement of being preoccupied with the new energy that supersedes the mimicry of the Android meme, machines extending themselves with the human beings on the sideline. Now, I want to ask you a clarifying comment about
that
because...
Is that a statement that you're quoting?
Yeah, that you made in this last 14
that's
minutes.
That's the translation. That's the transcription.
Yep, yep. What you said about the machines... I think a lot of times when people talk about the Android meme, somehow they are thinking more about the entertainment media world and not necessarily this dynamic of the machines extending themselves to the human being on the sideline.
And
now,
but the other part about the Android meme is that it slowly makes itself more human and makes you seem happier with technology. It's seducing you. And definitely the young kids, 18 or 10 to 20-year-olds today over the last 10 years, they have no problem with technology like the baby boomers did. The baby boomers had all this anxiety about pollution and this and that and Big Brother in 1984, and they kind of tended to get back to first nature, you know, get your commune or get someplace, drop out, get your cottage, you know, up in Ontario, get out of the cities. These kids don't live in that chemical body situation. They're in the chip body, and they're totally seduced, and I don't mean that negatively, at the friendliness of their technologies that they use. They can do anything rapidly and create attention and create little empires for themselves digitally. So the Android meme has given people the utopic situation for the what I call chip body, you know, extremely advanced over the last 10 years. So it's, yes, people think the Android meme is out to get you. No, I've always said, I said way back 20 years ago, the Android meme is making yourself look more and more human. In the end, the Android meme will show up as a clone of yourself, maybe five of them, and then if you want them, they'll look like you, and they'll help you do everything. You know what I mean? That'll be extreme service. Now, Ion calls this abundance by default, and Ion is here to help you understand this process so that you have a choice or you can have a different understanding and not be seduced into letting the Android meme make your life wonderful for you. That's what it's going to do.
We're not done. This is a very good right here, this little spot. Okay. So... here's the Android Me machines extending themselves. And this is like the talking houses and the GPS and the cars that drive for you now and they stop you if you think they think you're going to get in an accident.
Yeah, right.
Okay, very good. Now, here's the this Android meme function, this technology in your everyday life.
Yeah, you started to go into how people think it means Hollywood and conspiracies of market design. That's one-tenth of the Android meme. That's what you're noticing, and that's what you want to say, right?
I want to say that. And then the second thing I want to say is, let's talk about, you're saying Ion's here to help you. This is, I think, a piece of a really big Ionic engagement that a lot of people don't understand, because Ion's been very critical of, if you don't take your power, we will, you know, we want you to do this, but you're not doing it, so we're going to have to do it for you, and don't do it by default and all this. But this is the piece, this Android meme piece of understanding the relationship to the technologies that are supposedly making your life better, like the car that's stopping you from getting in the accident,
right,
that your insurance company has hired with its computers because they've calculated the chance of risk and all the rest of this, and they're modulating their algorithm of their huge empire that they've got, and they've decided that this little device needs to go in your car and whatever, okay, and it could make your life better. What is Ion's role in making, in helping us understand that so we could make a different choice?
Right. So the pattern, the great historical pattern that McLuhan discovered was that when a new environment is happening, like the printing press, the people, and it's happening in the collective mind, whatever that is, a meme, the 100th monkey, people individually are starting to read the book, the printed book, and reading the Bible, and having the right to interpret it themselves. So that leads to the idea of Protestant Reformation and Lutheranism and all that. But that was the effect of the Bible, of the printed book. And then over the next couple hundred years, more and more people reading. Nobody's reading much, you know, by 1500, even though a lot of books being made. But, you know, by 1700, 1750, the average peasant is actually reading a little bit. So over, and McLuhan said, literacy is the slowest developing environment. We show today how fast the internet came into the world, how fast Web 2.0 and all this stuff. Well, we use as a standard, you know, the 300 years for universal literacy or something with the book world. So the slowly spreading collective acceptance and cliche environment of printed books, that becomes a meme, and it's what Ion calls the world of language and social mortar. Not your personal creative powers, your ability to live forever, to go to anywhere, do anything with your body. There is some point in the outer kingdom where we have shared language, shared meanings, and shared memes. So the meme, so then the phase two is the digital world, the Android meme, I call it, it's an Android meme. The collective creation of a meme that happened from the printing press up to the satellite now is automatic within the machines. So since the machines came alive, they are imitating humans and developing collective awarenesses and collective biases. They're developing a meme, but it's an Android meme. Okay, so the historical pattern was that when you have a new environment, this is what McLuhan discovered, nobody's noticing the formation of the meme over 200 years with the printing press. But they are reacting to it. And so Shakespeare starts saying, let's go back and look at all those medieval kingdoms that we lived in, and they weren't interesting when they were an invisible environment because it was our present. But now they're the past because we got a new reality made by books that makes the medieval worlds something we see in our rearview mirror. So he goes back and examines them and makes plays out of them. It makes lessons and morals and aphorisms and excitement and pattern recognition. So what McLuhan noticed, that whenever a new technology comes in, starts making a new invisible meme, you know that's happening when everybody starts doing something about movies. For example, when movies became an art form, that means people start re-looking at all the Hollywood movies of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, because on TV, you have The Late Show, and it's replaying movies. No one ever had access to movies in their home before, so here's The Late Show in the 50s and 60s showing movies, so people have a chance to review movies, become aware of what they were, and relook at the period in the teens, 20s, 30s when the movies were a new medium, a new environment, and having effects leading to wars and all that stuff that nobody was fully aware of. So the pattern is that when a new environment comes in, it turns the old technology, the old meme, into an art form. And it's redone as an entertainment function or as a source of values or is corrected. So the French intellectuals started making a big deal out of Jerry Lewis movies. And Jerry Lewis movies were never taken serious by Americans because it was the invisible American environment. But the French intellectuals were from a different environment, and they looked at Jerry Lewis and said, there's something interesting. It's quite revealing the way he lives. He's the ultimate American. And so they started looking at these old movies, and then they developed the auteur theory. You know, Godard and these other directors, they started Truffaut and that. They were part of this intellectual group in the 50s writing for a French cinema analysis, and they started looking at these stupid B-grade McDonald's-like burger movies and making big deals, saying, look at that director, John Ford or John Huston. Man, that guy really knew what he was doing. He wasn't just a guy making Pulp Fiction or something. There's some thought going into this. So they turned the movie world intellectually into an art form, and meanwhile, humans were getting it on TV in America and re-looking at their life, and as Marshall said, they look back and they said, look at all that we forgot. You know, they're seeing in the footage in the movies what they drank and then just moved on and then watched another movie in 1929 the next week and then another movie all through the 30s and 40s and never went back and looked at them again. So it becomes a museum. It creates a new perception and perspective on where you've been. So this pattern of a new environment turns the older environment into an art form. Well, the Android meme is our present invisible environment during the period of my tiny note chart, 1960 to 1990. I say that when everybody gets online and starts using it in the 95, 96, that is the old environment becoming visible, and the Android meme is kind of a rearview mirror phenomenon. So what's sneaking up? What is the new environment that's sneaking up? It turns out to be Ion. And what does Ion do? He turns the Android meme phase 2 chip environment into an art form. He can mold it like a sculptor, like a painter, like an artist. He plays with it because he's the next step. He's the invisible environment. Now, Ion said that they are an expression of what I call the mystery landscape, but we will now be able to call the mystery landscape a mystery body because it's going to be all explained by Ion and proven and validated, and then it'll be an old hat. It won't be a big deal. Then you might say, well, what'll I do when I don't have anything to be mysterious about? You know what I mean? Or be impressed with. So there's an identity crisis there about the effect of Ion. And there'll be much resistance to what Ion's doing. But he is completing the McLuhan pattern of showing and saying, we have taken over the cloud because you didn't take charge. And all through history, that's the satire, Finnegan's Wake and Wyndham Lewis' books, showing humans always being robots to their new technologies and never stepping back collectively and getting an insight and maybe getting a little bit of an artistic control of it. They didn't become an orchestrator of their media. So Ion is telling us, this is the multi-leveled aspect of Ion, he is the voice of his human history saying, well, I'm a new environment, you're not taking a proper response to me, or a conscious response, so I'm going to turn you into an art form. And I'm going to be an art form for your past. And it's all going to be done for you like all previous technologies did for you. The previous technologies caused all kinds of friction, wars, and this and that, but overall, you know, people are sitting in pretty good places in the more abundant first world, and all that was built. You just go back 100 years before they had air conditioning, right? They didn't have toilets in their homes. So all this amazing progress on the material level of chemical body support and comforts was given to people by default. And, of course, privately, socially, their lives became wrecked because when you get it by default, you don't understand the dynamism. You don't know how to hop out of the environment that's been given to you. You don't know how to use it as an art form. And that is what Ion's representing. He's a new composer, Leonardo da Vinci, of all possible thinkings and scenarios, saying you still have to become aware of the water you're swimming in. And you're swimming in me right now, says Ion. You're swimming in us. And we're going to show you what we do to what you do notice. You do notice the chip body now because it's obsolete. It's been subsumed and turned into an art form by us. So you always notice the previous environment. So IAM wants to make us aware that we are fascinated with the Internet and study it and think we understand it and engage it, but again, we're subject to the unconscious effect that we've been made off-planet, off-chip body, so that we can see this, chip body. But we've moved into a new off-planet area, off-physical planet, into the non-physical planet, and we're actually looking at reality from that perspective and living it, taking the RNA drops, going to have the cold play, battery and all that, and we don't recognize, again, the mind's ability to understand the incomprehensible and to speak it. So does that begin to answer your question about what the role of ION is?
Yes. That was perfect. Absolutely perfect. And it was perfect, too, that you come around full circle. So with that, let's take a musical interlude. I'll play some music. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back. Thank you.